Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyappa and I have with me Abhishek Paul and Nirav Kharmudra to run you through the news and events of the week that was. Last week, India announced a 50% financial assistance for the semiconductor industry. Prime Minister Modi said at an event that India will become the third largest economy in the third term, warming up to the 2024 elections. The finance minister indicated the possibility of an IFSC listing potentially for Indian companies. Then the BJP launched En Makkal campaign in Tamil Nadu. And finally, in some bit of a bizarre news, the US claims to have UFO or non-human bodies in possession. All of this and more on this Bharat Varta Weekly. We bring you episodes on politics, policy and culture every week. If you like that kind of content, don't forget to follow, subscribe to us on your favorite platform to stay updated. All right, let's get on with this week's episode. Prime Minister Narendra Modi inaugurated the Semicon India 2023 conference in Gandhinagar on Friday. He said that India is establishing an entire ecosystem for the semiconductor industry to grow in the country and announced that technology firms will be given 50% financial assistance for setting up semiconductor manufacturing facilities in the country. He further added that the semiconductor industry will witness exponential growth in India and that the country is becoming a grand conductor for investments in the semiconductor sector. Nirav, earlier the government had announced, I think it was $7 billion or something of that sort, to set up semiconductor industry here, and then you're further seeing this 50% assistance as well. This is bound to spur the industry for sure.
So let's take a step back. So earlier in the PLI schemes, what the government has done is, of whatever sales you do, like what the Foxconn for the iPhone assembly, etc., they are giving 4 to 6% for a period of 5 years. So whatever you manufacture, whatever sales is there, that is there. On top of it, it was giving some earlier subsidized land and giving fast track clearance if you set up a semiconductor plant. But what has happened is with this whole China plus one, the US has its own thing about the CHIPS Act, where they've provide a lot more incentives, and TSMC is setting up, the leading semiconductor manufacturer is setting up a plant in Arizona in the US. And earlier there was some talk about like Vedanta and Foxconn together setting up one semiconductor fab. But see, Vedanta is a metals and mining conglomerate, right? Maybe its core skill set here would be managing operations in India, maybe setting up a plant or constructing the plant, but not the technology, what goes inside, and maybe getting in government clearances. Foxconn also is a low-end assembly, assembling iPhones. It's not at the heart of the chips. And yes, that JV has fallen through. You are having some interest from AMD. You are having interest from a few other companies. So now what India has done is that 50% of the cost that you spend, it is there on the Maiti website, the government will pay for it. Provided it's on an equal basis. So a lot of people say, oh, somebody's taking away our money. It is somebody's investing a few billion dollars. India will match it one for one. And this is like going in to say, this is a critical industry. India has the scale and scope. India has the labor land. It is also giving incentives and capital. So for large semiconductor companies, it's a very cyclical business. And every decade or so, we see fresh investments. So we missed the last few decades. There was in the 60s, Fairchild Semiconductors from the US wanted to set up something in India, but our bureaucracy was too much and we missed that out. Then we've seen Samsung and TSMC being at the complete cutting edge. But there is the other players like Intel, Qualcomm, AMD, all of those guys are also there. And there are a lot of the other semiconductors or the electronics which are used in, say, a little more cheaper consumer electronics, like in washing machines and fridge and LED displays. So India does not have a semiconductor industry. Right now what we have is electronics is mostly assembly. The chips are all imported. Taiwan is the leader for what you would call logic chips. And Korea is a leader for memory chips. And China is catching up fast. US has a lot of design, but slowly, slowly, a lot of the manufacturing has gone out. And we saw during COVID when all supply chains were shut, it was so difficult. Even cars could not be manufactured because they were lacking certain chips. This is a critical business. Now, this is using industrial policy. And before people come in and criticize, why should the government do this? The government had done that with Maruti Suzuki, if we all remember. That India did not have an auto industry. Indian cars up till then were fairly substandard. And we got the government to come in and put in half the money. And Suzuki, the Japanese conglomerate, set up. So we got the Maruti 800, the first car. And that led to huge auto component supplier network. That is why we have like Hyundai and a lot of other auto companies making those parts. And then Tatas, which were traditionally truck and bus manufacturers, got into cars. Mahindra, which was agricultural equipment manufacturers, also got into cars, right? So we saw the whole auto industry develop. For a lot of people, they may not know, but like cars are not produced in every country. It's only like very advanced industrial nations which do make cars. So that is one industry that India has kind of kick-started and helped. So this can happen. Otherwise, it's a very East Asian policy. In Taiwan, the TSMC was also set up with the government help. So here, India has kept the doors open. It's kept a framework. But technology will come from outside. The good thing is there will be a lot of labor requirement right from you start construction. So there's a lot of construction workers, etc. involved. Then you get people in the assembly plants or the lower end shop floor workers, skilled workers who are at a little bit higher level. And at the cutting edge of semiconductor design, as well as like in operations of the factory, running that. So in India, a lot of electronics engineers, they all end up going into software. But now we'll actually see an electronics industry develop. And India's import of electronics is actually equal to India's import of oil. This is one area where we are importing a lot. There are naysayers who say that India should just focus on services. But we have one fairly large domestic demand. Two, the world wants to move away from China, who's like the leader in the, what you would call the lower end semiconductors, the lower end electronics. So we want to try and get that business. As well as for country like Taiwan, while TSMC hasn't really put in things, it is like at very, like a geopolitical juncture where it could be very risky for TSMC to have all its eggs in one basket in case of a war broke out between China and Taiwan. So they need to diversify. Similarly with like Samsung and LG in South Korea. So we've laid out the framework for people to come in and invest. I think there are a lot of Indians in semiconductor design firms in Texas Instruments, in India as well as in the US. That's just one which comes to mind. But there are many other such companies. And I think this is going to kickstart another industry. And I believe that India is like a huge, large country with a very large labor force. So we need skilling of everyone. And we need multiple industries to be firing so that if there is like lack of demand or a slowdown in one, which say hypothetically could be software services, could be agriculture, could be something else. And then the other industries pick up and they cut the slack. So the intentions are great. Execution is yet to be seen. I think these things will take a decade to set up a plant and to set up and to be productive and to develop a whole ecosystem where you get other small component suppliers and everybody coming together and we form maybe a couple of semiconductor clusters within India. Probably will take a decade. But if this goes through and if it is successful, it can be like a massive success story. And it is like each time India has to level up in build other businesses, build other industries so as to provide employment for the large country. So absolutely, I think it's a very timely thing. It's more on the East Asian model where like the Japanese and the Koreans, the Taiwanese, the way they have kind of got industry set up and hopefully India follows on the same path.
And I like how they're looking at it very holistically from an ecosystem perspective as well, right? 300 colleges have been identified for starting courses on the semiconductor design. We definitely have an acute shortage. You know, a lot of our electronics folks, as you mentioned earlier, mean end up doing software or, you know, migrate abroad, right, for lack of opportunity in the core fields here. And US chipmaker AMD has announced that it will invest about $400 million over the next 5 years to build its largest chip center in Bangalore. Very positive news. And in the same vein, on Wednesday, Prime Minister Modi inaugurated Bharat Mandapam, the newly built International Exhibition cum Convention Center, IECC, in New Delhi. While addressing the ceremony, he said, on the basis of track record, in the third term of our government, India will become the world's third largest economy. He pointed out that India was in the 10th spot when he assumed power in 2014, and since then the country has risen to the 5th spot. He further added, the world will witness the rising stature of India when the newly built Bharat Mandapam will host the G20 summit. Abhishek, election season is around the corner, but I want to ask a different question, right? A lot of folks are very sanguine about the fact that, you know, India had to grow and, you know, whatever we are, wherever we are right now is like an obvious thing. It had to happen, right? But there were also a lot of things that, this government has done right in order for us to be in this situation, right?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on whether you kind of agree with the policies of this government or not, right? Like, there will be people who say that, you know, it's done a few big missteps as well, right? Like demonetization, which kind of slowed down the growth rate for a couple of years. I think overall, the government has been kind of prudent with how it has managed the economy of the country. I think, especially during the pandemic, we can probably give a lot of kudos to how, you know, they managed the crisis, etc. They did not sort of go on a massive spending spree like some of the more advanced countries in the West, you know, which are still sort of reeling from the effects of that in the inflationary cycle today, right? So, yeah, I think, according to me, it's like a solid B+ kind of management of the economy. I think we also have a lot of complaints about few features, right? Like how the tax administration seem to be like crazy revenue hungry, you know, targeting entrepreneurs, constantly targeting new businesses. It's clear that the government recognizes that there should be ease of doing business, but has it been sort of fully realized and established through the bureaucracy? I mean, we still have question marks. So, yeah, I think I would say it's been on the whole a sort of positive story, but obviously there are a few areas where, you know, it could have done a lot better. But coming back to the statement, what I found interesting was not that the third largest economy part, but the third term part, right? Which kind of shows that he's now fully into the election sort of season and he's very confident of, you know, returning back in 2024. I thought that was the bigger statement because, as you said, like mathematically, unless we do some disasters, right, 2027, 2028 is basically the time frame based on current sort of projections that India will, you know, surpass Germany and Japan, right, who are in the third, fourth spots right now. And India should be hitting the $5 trillion GDP mark around that time frame, right? We'll sort of inch ahead of both Germany and Japan in that period. So, yeah, I think the opposition and some others have made the point that, you know, this is like an arithmetic inevitability, and maybe it is, maybe it is not. But I thought what is more interesting is the firm conviction of the PM to go ahead and say that he will be returning for a third term.
Yeah. No, but I kind of disagree a little bit with you that, you know, it cannot be spreadsheet extrapolation, right? That, we have the momentum, we will kind of grow for our size and so on. And, you know, you could call it geopolitics, whatever else, right? I mean, if you look at 2004 as well, right, a lot of policy reforms happened, but then, you know, we have that whole lost decade in between. Not even counting all of the, like, all the black swan stuff that can happen, right? I mean, whether it is terror attacks or COVID, etc.
If you see the first few years of the UPA, yeah, they were having pretty high growth rate, right, based on the NDS policy. So I'm saying that the new government, even if it wants to, it can't really stop the momentum in the first 2-3 years. Maybe if impact of their change would come post the $5 trillion mark when we hit. That is assuming they will do something drastically different, which is also quite unlikely in my view, right? Because what is going to happen is probably, like Karnataka is a good example right now. So it's a government which is pivoting more towards welfarism and saying that, development will have to take a back seat, right? So it's basically a question of priorities and things like that. But I don't think that kind of immediately stops the growth momentum generally in the economy.
All right. On the topic of the economy itself, on Friday, Finance Minister Ms. Nirmala Sitharaman said that Indian companies listed and unlisted can now directly list on the International Financial Services Center, IFSC, in Gujarat's GIFT City. While speaking at an event organized by market regulators SEBI, she said the move would help Indian companies access capital from investors around the world and also get better valuations. At present, Indian companies are allowed to list in overseas markets through the American Depository Receipt, the ADR, and the Global Depository Receipt, the GDR. Nirav, this whole GIFT City and IFSC has been, many, many years in the making. Are we going to see something tangible happen, shortly?
Yeah, so see, like as you mentioned, so ADR, like Infosys, for example, or HDFC Bank, all these companies have ADRs outstanding. So what are those ADRs? So ADRs is somebody pulls up, like a foreign entity pulls up, buys a lot of shares of, say, Infosys, and that's a company which owns, only asset it owns is Infosys shares. And that company lists on NASDAQ, right? And issues shares of its own. So that is a, if it is listed in Europe or London, it's called GDR, Global Depository Receipt. It's a very American concept. It's like America and rest of the world is like global. So now what it can do is you can have a dual listing. So for example, you can issue shares in GIFT City denominated in US dollars. So for example, Infosys can have dual listing. So there are two classes of shares, which is you'll have Infosys, say the shares which are listed on NSE, BSE, as well as the ones in GIFT City denominated in US dollars. What it does is it makes it easier for an average US mutual fund or a pension fund or like any global fund which can buy securities, buy stocks listed in GIFT City. So that's the aim. It's, they want to make GIFT City like an equivalent of Hong Kong. So I'll give you the Chinese example. So in China, there is A shares, which are the Chinese stocks listed in Hong Kong, in Shanghai. But in Hong Kong, there are a lot of Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong dollar does not have capital controls, is like freely tradable. So these are called H shares. And a lot of US mutual funds, pension funds, a lot of investors basically buy the H shares in China because it gives you access to the biggest Chinese companies and you do not have capital control, difficulty of moving money out. In India, you have to register as a foreign portfolio investor. There is like a lot of gray area on taxation, etc. So that kind of makes it a little bit easier. What this could also probably do is easily allow like NRIs to buy stocks without having to pay like full income tax and then claim it back in the year after, which say an NRI has to do for stocks listed on NSE, BSE. So this is one way of slowly opening up India's capital account. You've created a sandbox or a small gateway. Again, execution remains the key. Even the all the Hong Kong listed shares did not start trading massively overnight. There will always be problems. There might be sort of liquidity problems. One obvious problem that we can foresee is who is the market maker on the exchanges easily. If you do not allow domestics to be part of that market, maybe it doesn't take off. So I think, again, all the regulators, SEBI, etc., all the big market participants, they all have to come in. This is another place where you can say this China plus one in like Morgan Stanley Emerging Market Index, MSCI EM. I think China was 32% and India is the next biggest at like 13-14%. And everywhere there's diversification, China plus one. So I think India, Taiwan, Korea, Indonesia, these are the countries which are getting allocation as money moves away from China. But this route might make it easier. So basically you might see all major Indian companies. So you could say the Reliance, TCS, Infosys, big banks like HDFC, ICICI, etc. All of them could potentially have a dual listing or like say a startup. So Make My Trip was one company which was actually incorporated overseas and then listed on NASDAQ. So it does not have local shares, but was listed on NASDAQ. Or say like a big startup, which is growing very rapidly, might choose to list only in the IFC in GIFT City, right? And even earlier, like a lot of the people are saying that for Wipro and Infosys, it was a US company with all its customers in the US, all bulk of its shareholders in the US, only with Indian costs, effectively, right? So maybe you could see like two classes of shareholding.
Right. And here I think we should clarify that a direct listing is different from an IPO or an initial public offer. So the direct listing is when you take your existing shares and put it on the market versus an IPO where you have to create shares, right? I mean, access demand and then create shares. All right, on to some political news. Tamil Nadu BJP has launched a six-month-long Padayatra, Enman Enmakkal, or My Land, My People. This was on July 28th, ahead of the 2024 Lok Sabha elections. The poll campaign will cover 234 assembly constituencies in the state and was launched by party leader and Union Home Minister Amit Shahji. Tamil Nadu BJP leader Annamalai will lead the Padayatra, covering over 1,770 kilometers by foot and the remaining distance in the rural areas by vehicle. Abhishek, we saw a Bharat Jodo Yatra and now we're seeing an Enman Enmakkal Yatra. So is Annamalai being inspired by, Rahul Gandhi?
Maybe. Who knows? So I think the BJP is very ambitious in its targets for 2024. I believe they have publicly stated that they would like to win 25 plus seats in Tamil Nadu, which right now seems like a very tall task, right? Given the dominance of the DMK party right now. But yeah, I think this seems like a major effort to make sort of maximum possible gains in Tamil Nadu from a state where historically the BJP hasn't had a big presence or hasn't had a significant number of seats that it has won. From time to time, they have allied with the ADMK and the Lok Sabha results kind of swing from one party to the other at different times, right? So it's kind of hard to predict, but basically post Jayalalitha with the sort of division of the ADMK, etc., I think there is definitely a space for the BJP to emerge as the major pole on the other side of DMK, right? So, and possibly gain some ground at the expense of ADMK overall. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this Padayatra goes, how the BJP is able to sort of convert all this interest that it has generated on the ground into seats and votes. So yeah, I think obviously the BJP will face some issues in some parts of northern India or eastern India where, you know, they have kind of maxed out in 2014 and 2019, and you will have some sort of attrition of seats in those states. And so it is always, you know, looking for newer places to sort of gain ground, right? And Tamil Nadu is obviously one of the states where it is kind of still very small in terms of seats and presence. And so this is like a major push to give the BJP some big upside for 2024.
And it seems to also have a lot of support from the center. At least one central minister would address each of the 10 major rallies that have been planned during the Yatra, right? And you had the Union Home Minister himself flag this off. All right, we'll end with a bit of a bizarre news. Last Wednesday, former U.S. intelligence officer David Grush claimed that the U.S. government is in possession of UFOs and the bodies of their non-human pilots. Grush made the statement under oath in front of a House Oversight Committee in Washington. In June, he had alleged that the U.S. government was hiding evidence of extraterrestrials, which sparked a firestorm, leading to the Oversight Committee launching an investigation into his claims. My first thoughts when I heard this was, you know, did they find another pound of cocaine in the White House or something like that, right? I mean, or did they find another laptop with more shady people connected to Hunter Biden or whatever? Or was, Nancy Pelosi taking off and flying over, you know, China or Taiwan or whatever it is, right? Crazy. I mean, there seems to be nonstop entertainment from the U.S. In these matters, right? But in all seriousness, a lot of people have speculated about Area 51 and the kind of experiments that have happened there. There's this person called Bob Lazar, for instance, who worked in the government agency and has made a bunch of claims. For those who are interested, I mean, do watch more than a few Joe Rogan episodes to get the lay of the land on this whole UFO. I don't know, should I call it conspiracy theory, right? It's pretty interesting. We'll find out maybe in a couple of weeks what they were actually trying to hide or distract us from. But in any case, so for all the UFO fans out there, there's another rabbit hole that you can spend exploring this week. But that brings us to the end of this podcast. Upcoming next week, we have in the Velina Stock Series, we have an interesting discussion on Wagner in Belarus and what that means, right? We hosted Jacek Bartosiak. Interesting conversation. Do check it out. If you liked our content, don't forget to rate and review us on all audio platforms. It'll really help us reach more people. And don't forget to like this video on YouTube if you are watching on YouTube, so that the algo gods can smile upon us. That's it from Abhishek, Nero and myself. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week with more news and more commentary.